One, hold the paper up. One, two, three.
You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, December 18th, 2013. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Emily Bazelon from Slate on the ruling yesterday, or I guess Monday now, by Judge Richard Leon, that the National Security Agency is probably violating the Constitution in its program to collect telephony metadata, I guess. Telephone metadata. Also on the program today, Peter Schiff. Remember that guy? He's an idiot. That's all I'm going to tease that story with. Also, Glaxo makes an announcement. It's no longer going to be giving kickbacks to doctors for prescribing its medication. Baby steps, folks. Baby steps. Also, food stamps looking at another cut for 2014 because we have not punished the poor enough. So too with those who have lost their jobs and remained unemployed for more than 26 weeks. They too, nearly 1.4 million Americans, are staring at a loss of unemployment benefits. And worker morale for federal workers is at an all-time low. No surprise there. And then just this bizarre story of a guy who worked at the EPA and defrauded the agency over $1 million. It's not only a bizarre story, and we don't have time right now to get into it. We'll get into it after the interview. It's not only a bizarre story, but I am going to make, I don't know if we'll do any predictions for 2014. As you know, this will be the last week of live programming. We will have best ofs the week of Christmas, and then we will return after the first, probably on the third, because it's such a weird calendar this year. So maybe at the beginning, when we come back, we'll do predictions for the year. But I'm going to make an early prediction for 2014. This story of the EPA official who defrauded the EPA will become the subject, will become another talking point for the right on why global warming is fake. There is no doubt in my mind. I mark my words, folks. This is their next Benghazi. And I was just watching. I did Chris Hayes last night, and I was watching Daryl Issa apparently went to Texas to have some type of, I don't know, a fake congressional hearing on some fake scandal. I think it was the Navigators, because James O'Keefe is now making videos about the Navigators. And some Texas lawmaker, actually, I think he may have been actually a congressperson, was saying, this is just like, this Navigator thing is just as compelling as the other horrible things this administration has done, like Benghazi, the IRS scandal. What was the other?
Now they've done Benghazi.
It's not a cover-up. Benghazi, the IRS scandal. There was some other thing. I can't even remember what it was.
The firearms one.
Oh, yeah. Fast and Furious.
There you go.
And I just thought, you know, I understand the use of this rhetoric, and you talk about, but you look back over the Bush administration years. The invasion and occupation of Iraq costing, by the most conservative accounts, hundreds of thousands of people their lives. Millions of people are refugees. Thousands of U.S. servicemen killed. Thousands and women. Thousands of U.S. servicemen and women injured. Torture. The financial crisis that destroyed our economy and left millions of people unemployed. I mean, those are just the ones, you know. And these guys are talking about Benghazi and the non-existent IRS scandal and the non-existent Fast and Furious scandal. I mean, it's just.
Yes, we are. Yeah.
It's just a bizarre time we're living in, folks. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Emily Bazelon. About what is a real scandal, the ongoing self-licking ice cream cone that is our national security state. We will take a break. We'll be right back after this. Hello, listener of the Majority Report. This is Sam Seder with an important announcement. Credo, as you know, is a sponsor of the show for this month. They have a great plan that's going to last until December ends. You can go to credomobile.com/Sam. You can pick up any of their new phones or old phones, but they got new phones. Winky, winky. Check them out. 50% off your new phone. Plus, they will pay you, or they will give you a credit of up to $350 on your Credo phone bill to pay off your switching fee. You know all about Credo. Credo Action fights for progressive values. They fight against Tea Partiers. They fight Democrats who are pushing their agenda that is too far to the right. They're a great organization. They also give 1% of their revenues to progressive nonprofits. What's not to like? You have a phone already. Maybe you want one of those phones that are not Android phones. Well, Credo has them now. Go to credomobile.com/Sam. Support this sponsor that's supporting this show. Check it out now. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome Emily Bazelon. She is a Slate senior editor and the Truman Capote Fellow at the Yale Law School. Welcome to the program, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
I got to ask you, the Truman Capote Fellow?
Yes. Truman Capote's estate has donated money to Yale Law School to support nonfiction writing, so that's why I get to have that amazingly cool title.
That is an amazingly cool title. All right, so let's talk about this. This is the court case on Monday. Judge Richard Leon. He was a Bush appointee judge. He is a judge with the Washington Circuit Court. And this is the first time that a federal court has ruled the NSA metadata collection program unconstitutional. Tell us what the break the ruling down for us.
Well, the ruling has kind of two really important parts. The first part is Judge Leon's skepticism that the government really has shown it has a compelling interest in collecting all this metadata. And I think the most shocking part of the opinion was Judge Leon saying that the government had not cited a single instance in which this database solved an urgent terrorism case, thwarted an imminent terrorist attack. And that's important because the whole idea of having all this data searchable without a warrant, without judicial review, is that we really need to get access to tracing down terrorists very quickly. Yet the government couldn't cite a single instance in which that had been, had actually really helped, had, and had really mattered.
And part of this, I mean, so this is basically a test as to whether or not the government's interest is compelling and unique enough to warrant superseding the Fourth Amendment. And his argument was that, you know, I guess the first part of that argument was that you're just looking to do it faster, right? I mean, isn't that part of it? Like, you already have the ability to do this. You just want to do it faster.
Exactly. That, you know, no one is arguing that the government can't search for terrorists. This is about how much searching can happen without a warrant. And the way this metadata is collected, the government and NSA starts with what they call a seed. That's a phone number that's associated with a terrorist group. Then from that seed, they can, they've given themselves the power to look at all the calls from that number, and then all the calls from those numbers, and then all the calls from the second tier numbers. So we are talking about everybody's metadata very quickly. And metadata isn't the content of phone calls, but it's everything else. So people know exactly who you're calling and how long you stayed on the phone for and when. And so that's, you know, a lot of personal information. And the other important part of Judge Leon's ruling was to say people really do have a privacy interest in this. And it's one that the Supreme Court has never really dealt with, because all of this intense using of cell phones and telephones that we do is relatively new.
And in this instance, and I want to get to this that second part in just a moment, but he cited, I guess he used like a Domino's pizza example. And I just want to, you know, walk through this to make it really clear. So the seed, I guess their use of the seed calls involves, like, if I call Domino's, then Domino's is now sort of like part of the catchment, as it were, right? I mean, it becomes almost infected. And then anybody else who calls Domino's also becomes part of the catchment.
Exactly. And from that example, it's a really good concrete way of understanding why it is that everybody's metadata is in this database. However distant terrorism may seem from you, once you call a place like Domino's that someone associated with the terrorist might have called, you are in there too.
Right. And then so on, et cetera. And so that's one of the big problems. And then you turn to the second issue. And when this when the Snowden disclosures first came about, people very often cited this case, Smith v. Maryland. And that's the one that where Judge Leon says, he basically says that case is not applicable here. So let's walk through that for us.
Yeah, sure. That's a 1979 Supreme Court ruling in which the court said that if you voluntarily give your billing and your calling information to the phone company, just as part of your normal having a phone, then you are not expecting to keep that information private anymore, and the government can search it. Now, the question is, that was 1979. What relevance does this have to the metadata the government now collects? And the NSA has all along been arguing, look, this case is very much on point, and until and unless the Supreme Court changes its mind, we're not violating the Fourth Amendment. all the court judicial review before Judge Leon has agreed with the Supreme Court on that point. Judge Leon said, you know what, we just live in such a different world now. The Supreme Court could never have imagined all the data that these phone companies collect on us, and it's time to just rethink the relevance of this old case.
And he leans heavily on a 2012 case, Jones, that involved GPS. Is that right?
That's right. That's a case in which the court said it was unconstitutional for the police to put a GPS tracker on your car without a warrant. And in that case, there's a lot of really cautionary language about new technology and how invasive it can be to people's privacy and how the courts want to make sure that the police are getting warrants before they use that kind of technology.
And how, you know, I've been reading quite a bit on the perspective that many writers are having on this, court watchers and whatnot, and people who are digging into this, think that's sort of his argument is not terribly compelling there, because the metadata that is supposedly being collected of those phones is really isolated to the same type of metadata that was collected in Smith v. Maryland. What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, I think that it's similar in that it's on your phone bill. On the other hand, the amount that we use our cell phones, the way they are basically tracking every single message we're sending out, you know, the way we're talking about text messages and emails as well as phone calls, makes this, in terms of the amount of information we're giving away, it just is very different world than the 1979 phone use in Smith versus Maryland. So to me, the distinction that Judge Leon is drawing here makes a lot of sense.
So it's less that the phones have more technological capability, but more about how we as human beings interact in some ways with our phones.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept. Now, let's go through just a couple of the other sort of issues here that are different than any case that was brought up, let's say, a year or two ago. And we should also say, well, first off, before we even get to there, well, let's start with this, that there is now one of the things that became very clear is that the issue of standing, at the very least, to bring these cases seems to be now resolved. This, just walk us through what that means, both in terms of what it literally means insofar as standing, but also what the implications are of that going forward with other cases.
Well, standing is just the ability to get into court to have your case heard. And the Constitution says that you have to have a live case or controversy. And over the years, there's been lots of law, lots of rulings about what exactly that means, who gets to come into court for what kind of case. When people have tried to challenge the NSA's data collection and surveillance before, the courts have generally said, you know what, you can't prove that your data was actually collected because this is all secret, so you don't have standing. It was basically an easy way for courts to just stay out of this whole situation, this whole question. But now we know from the Snowden revelations that essentially everybody's metadata is being collected, and the government has essentially conceded that point, and that is why the plaintiffs in this particular case had standing in Judge Leon's view.
And so how does – now, we should also say that there was another federal court in San Diego that a couple of months ago, I think it was, found – I'm not exactly sure. But tell us what that finding was. Do you know that case? I think it was a Judge Miller. And that case failed in – or at least the finding was such that this was not a violation of the Fourth Amendment. Tell us a little bit about that case.
Well, you're right. I mean, that case was also about the same constitutional questions. And then there's also a question of whether the NSA is violating the federal law that we think is called FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And that court said that the answer was no, saw this differently from Judge Leon. There is another case pending, a suit in New York that the ACLU has brought, and I think what we're going to see over the next months are a bunch of rulings from different district courts. That's the first level. And then also we're going to start to see some appeals happening pretty quickly. Judge Leon stayed his order. That means it doesn't go into effect until after there's an appeal. So that means the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the federal appeals court in New York and a couple of other states, will get to weigh in on this. And, you know, eventually these suits, one of them presumably will probably make it up to the Supreme Court. By then, we'll have a bunch of different judges weighing in on these questions.
And we should say, in this case, the judge stayed his decision basically to give the government an opportunity to appeal because this is such an important national security question, I guess. He is basically ruled that, look, the two plaintiffs, Larry Klayman and Charles Strange, they probably did have their constitutional rights violated. I'm going to stay the order. And this only applies to them, but because they did this based on the fact that they're Verizon customers, and we know from Edward Snowden's leaks that Verizon customers were subject to the same treatment, that's why the ACLU can bring this case in New York.
That's exactly right. And the other procedural just point to make to finish it off is that this is about a preliminary injunction. So the reason Judge Leon said they'll probably win is that at this standard, this early part of the proceedings, he doesn't have all of the evidence beforehand, and he is making this initial determination. So there'll be an appeal of his ruling, and then presumably the case will come back, and it will be fully aired before him, and then it will go back up. So there's lots of different stages to this. And he was doing the prudent thing here by not putting into effect what would be a very dramatic change in government policy in order to give the higher courts a chance to weigh in.
And do you have a sense? I mean, so this when the government appeals, it goes to the First Circuit of Appeals in D.C., which of course is not only considered, I guess, the second highest court more or less in the country. But it is also been in the news because this is the court that the filibuster reform was at least predicated upon filling those empty judgeships there, I guess. And so
yeah.
Do you have a sense of with the new judges coming on where that court might go with this? I mean, can we because of the nature and the way that they hear these appeals, where they do a sort of three judges picked at random, is there any way to sort of predict, or do we really need to know who the judges are first? And even then, is there a way for us to predict where this is going to go?
Well, that's a really good point and a good question. You're right. The way a federal appeals court works, there's a panel of three judges that hears the case. And that is random. It could be three conservative Republican appointees. It could be three more liberal judges picked by Democrats. But after that initial panel hearing, there is this other step, which has the Latin name en banc review. And that's just a way of saying that at that point, the whole appeals court, in the D.C. Circuit's case, that's 12 active judges. They all review the case. So at that point, the composition of the case and the ideologies of the judges really do start to matter and become more predictable. And you're also right that President Obama has recently appointed three people to that court. So it is no longer dominated by judges picked by Republican presidents as it was before.
And so, I mean, at the end of the day, when we sort of analyze the impact of this case, give me a sense of how you think this is going to impact the next round of cases. I mean, what will be taken from Judge Leon's ruling, and how will that sort of impact what other cases we hear, at least on a trial judge level on the first non-appellate level?
Well, this is a really hard set of questions, whether there's a constitutional violation here. And I think inevitably, as we've already seen, judges are going to make different calls about this. The question I have about this ruling is whether it is a wake-up call both for Congress to do something and also for the NSA itself to reform its own practices, because there's nothing stopping the NSA from changing the way it does business. And if it's true that they are not thwarting imminent terrorist attacks with this enormous data collection, then you would hope that some people inside the agency would start to question whether they are, in fact, violating people's privacy more than is really necessary.
Yeah, and so we've already seen, I think yesterday, Harry Reid announced that he was more open, it seems, to legislation that would reform the NSA process. I think Wyden and Udall were already citing this case as a need for reform. And so in many ways, the implications of this are almost more sort of political and policy than legal.
I think that's right, and it's a really interesting effect that one district court judge can have, right? He only has the authority in his own courtroom, but he has managed to change the whole political conversation about this kind of data collection.
And I would imagine also it starts to begin to implicate the sort of conventional wisdom on the question as to whether or not Edward Snowden is a legitimate whistleblower.
I think that's right, too. I mean, that was a point that I wanted to make when I was writing about this week, is that, you know, we are seeing the government, the Obama administration, saying they are intent on prosecuting Edward Snowden. Well, if he led to these revelations that have shown that a government program is different than what the NSA presented it as, because we know that's true, and is also potentially unconstitutional, then you might argue that he should be hailed as a hero, or at least not sent to prison for the leaks that he did.
Right. I mean, this definitely makes it less definitive. I mean, it's much harder for people to sort of definitively say that he's not a whistleblower, because clearly, if it was just up to Judge Leon, he would undoubtedly be one, it seems to me.
I think that's right. And, you know, the other thing is that there is just no question we would not have this case. These plaintiffs would not have had standing, would not have gotten into court without the Snowden leaks. And so in that sense, you really see a direct cause and effect and a huge impact here.
And you know, one other aspect of this that really strikes me is that this really casts into sort of bright light the difference between for lack of a better word, our normal judicial process and the sort of the parallel track that is the FISA court. I mean, one of the things that has struck me since the beginning of these revelations and the sort of the subsequent drip of rulings that have been released from the FISA court is how the FISA court has changed in its nature from the way that it was set up. From a court that basically issued national security bench warrants into one that was interpreting law. Can you just talk about the different implications? Because, you know, one court is adversarial and another court is just the government there arguing there's no one to even appeal the rulings.
Right. And you can argue that it's maybe not even a court in the sense that it was completely secret and closed. And as you're saying, there's no adversarial process. It's the government coming, making a representation about why they need to do surveillance without a warrant, and the judges ruling up or down. And as Judge Leon pointed out, there have been 15 judges over 35 years, or I'm sorry, 15 judges issuing 35 rulings saying that this metadata collection was constitutional and allowing it to go forward. It was only Judge Leon who disagreed in the open court, where you have, you know, you have scrutiny, you have a sense of what is actually going on. And I think that really does make, in this case, it made all the difference.
Yeah, well, you have a plaintiff, right? I mean, you actually have someone who's arguing against the government's case that this is legal. Where in the FISA court, you don't. And I'm not even clear on what the process is. I mean, is there any type of appellate process for the interpretations of the FISA court by a plaintiff? I mean, is there even a – I mean, how would someone – if someone dissented, and I guess the issue is that they wouldn't know to dissent, but – If someone had dissented against the FISA court rulings that said, yes, not just in this instance, you know, we're not going to just issue a warrant you, but this is, we're going to give you this blanket authority based upon your argument as to what the interpretation of the amended FISA Act is or the Patriot Act is, there's no one to argue against that.
Right. I mean, the judges themselves can be skeptical and ask questions. And there have been instances in which the FISA court got worried that the government was overstepping its bounds, misrepresenting the data collection, or just going beyond the scope of an order. So we now have those rulings. Those were only made public after the Snowden revelations. But you're also right. This is a much more limited kind of judicial review.
Right. And I think one of the things that those released opinions showed, too, is that the FISA court really has no mechanism in which to make the NSA comply with its orders.
Right. There is that problem as well. I mean, one hopes that the NSA would do so, but there is a sort of, you know, hidden nature to a lot of this. And I think also the FISA court, you know, whenever you have judges ruling in secret and only hearing one side of the story, you just wonder whether they're going to be somewhat captured by the whole process, and is one in which it's kind of thankless for them to be protesting. Also, the FISA court judges are selected to a large degree by Chief Justice John Roberts, and he was selecting a lot of conservative Republicans to serve on that court. We know that.
And so just from a practical standpoint, I mean, when do you think what is the timing of something like this to be brought up on appeal? I mean, what literally happens next?
Well, the appeal to the D.C. Circuit is expedited. So it's going to happen pretty quickly over the next, you know, weeks. And I think we can probably expect an opinion from them in the coming months, you know, sometime this winter or spring. And then, as I said before, there will be other cases that start to bubble up as well. I guess the big question will be, could this come up for Supreme Court review in the term for next year? That seems pretty quick, but I don't think it's completely impossible, although it might be more likely to happen the year after next.
Well, assuming that it goes to appeal rather quickly and that there is a ruling and one side or the other will appeal to the Supreme Court, what is the window for the Supreme Court to accept, to certification?
Well, they accept cert petitions all year round. They take a break in the summer for a little while, but essentially they can do that whenever they want, and they can move as quickly as they want to. I have to say, though, I would be really surprised if this issue ends up squarely being decided by the Supreme Court, because I would really expect the president, whether it's President Obama or someone else by the time this comes up, to make some changes, because it would just be so dramatic for the Supreme Court to rule this kind of program to be unconstitutional. I would think whoever is in office would really try to avoid that.
What, based upon what Judge Leon ruled, what would the NSA have to do to essentially avoid this notion of them violating the Fourth Amendment?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I don't think there's just one answer. I think you can see a few points of potential legal vulnerability for the NSA, and they could try to change one of them and then go back and see if Judge Leon would find the change acceptable. So, for example, they collect all this data, but then they go in and search and analyze it without a warrant. So one thing they could do would be to say, well, we're going to keep collecting it, but we won't search and analyze it unless we have what's called reasonable and articulable suspicion. In other words, that we have one target in mind who we're looking for, and we can tell you why we're worried about that particular target. That's one kind of change they could make that might reassure a judge like this one.
Okay. Well, Emily Bazelon, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate your walking us through this, and it's obviously something that we've all got to pay attention to over the next coming weeks and months.
Yes, agreed, and thanks so much for your great questions.
All right, folks. It is that. Should we do this EPA story now?
I don't know.
You should really have a microphone on.
I think we should.
That wasn't my fault.
That wasn't your fault? That was Matt's fault?
That was my fault.
All right. Yeah, let's talk about this because
I was going to make
when we
joke.
Get into the fun half of the show, although this is a pretty fun story.
This story is
it's bizarre.
Incredibly fun.
When we get into the fun part of the show, we will talk about Peter Schiff, and we will I will also talk about that Glaxo story, which is fascinating because the Glaxo story is indicative of one of the problems that we have in healthcare. And I would also argue that at least part of the reason why we have seen the flattening of the increase in healthcare expenses has been because so many drugs have gone off patent. And we are starting to see a less ambitious and aggressive program by drug companies to essentially set up to turn doctors into traveling salesmen and commission them, basically, on how much they medicate us. It's one part of it. But and we will also, in the funner half, talk about the fun story on how our Congress is going to cut food stamps and also screw over the unemployed. But in the meantime, this is from NBC. Michael Isikoff, the national investigative correspondent. And again, really, this is just a matter of a countdown before this turns into a grand indictment against anybody who is against fracking, against anybody who is against who wants to impact global climate change. I imagine they will somehow implicate the Clean Water Act. They will say that we should be polluting rivers more, all because of this one case. It is a bizarre
surprise
case.
They haven't already.
No,
they're slow on the uptake.
The story says that there is already two investigations, congressional investigations on this, which is, typical. You're talking about someone who defrauded the agency of $1 million. That's obviously been, he's been arrested, and it appears, I think, convicted at this point, or he pled guilty. So the hearings are probably costing more than this one fraud case, would be my guess. But it's interesting to sort of compare and contrast to sort of every other incredible fraud that has taken place over the past couple of years. But that being the case, apparently the EPA's highest paid employee, who received approximately $200,000 a year, defrauded the EPA of nearly $1 million in salary and other benefits over a decade. How did he do this? Well, he basically got paid for work that he did not do. And even more specifically, this guy whose name was Beal, John C. Beal, an NYU grad with a master's from Princeton, like I say, was earning a salary and bonuses of $206,000 a year. He was the highest paid official at the EPA. He bilked the government on $900,000 by not showing up for work for literally at least 2 years. But that's not the amazing thing. He went for an 18-month stretch in 2011 where he did absolutely no work. He got plane trips, first-class plane trips, first-class accommodation at hotels, at various spots across the country. By telling EPA officials that when he was taking these trips or when he was gone for up to 18 months, he was doing intelligence work for the CIA.
Can we get an applause, please?
Either. At CIA headquarters in Langley or in Pakistan. At one point, he claimed to be urgently needed in Pakistan because the Taliban was torturing his CIA replacement there. He sent an email.
His wife calls him. She's like, I found an amazing ski deal for like 6 months.
Don't worry. I'm going to email.
Don't worry. I'll say that my supervisor is being tortured by the Taliban. I got it.
He emailed, I guess, his boss, McCarthy, who I guess is now the, he said, due to recent events that you've probably read about, I'm in Pakistan, he wrote in an email. In December 18th of 2010, he did not return for 18 months. Got the call on Thursday and left Friday. Hoped to be back for Christmas. Ho, ho, ho. And then he didn't show up for another 18 months. It turns out that the inspector, the assistant inspector general for investigations at the EPA, a guy named Patrick Sullivan, found out that not only did he have no relationship with the CIA at all, he confirmed that Beale didn't even have a security clearance. And he spent much of the time he was purportedly working for the CIA at his Northern Virginia home riding bikes, doing housework, and reading books, or at a vacation house on Cape Cod. He's never even been to Langley, said Sullivan. The CIA has no record of him ever walking through the door. In 2008, Beale didn't show up at the EPA for 6 months, telling his boss that he was part of a special multi-agency election year project relating to candidate security. And he billed the government almost $60,000 for 5 trips to California, purportedly to provide candidate security that were purely for, quote, personal reasons. This is his lawyer acknowledging this. He also claimed at one point to be suffering from malaria that he got while serving in Vietnam. According to his lawyer's filing, he didn't have malaria and he never served in Vietnam. When he was first questioned by his alleged CIA undercover work by the EPA, Beale just brushed him aside by saying, well, of course, he couldn't reveal it. And then later, after he sort of copped to this whole thing, he told his friends at the EPA and his colleagues at the EPA that he actually was, in fact, working for the CIA, but he was going to take one for the team. And that he was going to go to jail to protect his fellow CIA workers.
What we're doing in Afghanistan is too important.
This is too big. Apparently, he was caught when this inspector general was like, hey, this is weird. Everybody went to his retirement party a year and a half ago on a yacht. And the guy is still drawing a salary. So, I mean... The lawyer is saying, obviously, that, look, the guy obviously was driven by greed, but he has also come to realize with the help of his therapist, this is according to his attorney, that his theft and deception were animated by a highly self-destructive and dysfunctional need to engage in excessively reckless, risky behavior. And he was driven to manipulate those around him with the fabrication of grandiose narratives that are fueled by his insecurities. So it is obviously a sad case for a guy who has some genuine mental, emotional, psychological issues. But it's also sort of an amazing way to get off from coming into work.
I was going to say, I don't know about all that stuff about his issues, but when I read this, I was pissed because you guys give me all this flack for how effective I am in getting vacation days, and I just stood in awe of the master when I read this. Yeah. I was like, that is just taking.
Wait till we get the special investigator of the Majority Report to check out this whole yoga retreat thing.
Yeah, I'm really. Yeah, I gotta go on
that. Turns out, that Michael's actually at home watching the duck show, the duck show marathon. What's going on?
What's happening? You guys don't hear that in your ear pieces?
No. What's going on?
The show is just our voices
static?
It's going out in one of the ears.
Channels?
Yeah, channels.
Oy. All right. Well,
I don't hear anything, but
let's continue on. We will fix it in post. We got to take a break. We'll head into the funner half of the program. Remember, folks, you can help us fix whatever technological problem we now have by becoming a member. Matt's just weirdly just pressing at things.
I'm trying to make sure
yeah.
Plugged in as good
yeah.
As possible.
No, I think that's fine. We'll figure it out. If it's happening with both of us, it's not going to be any of the individual individual cords. Yes, maybe it's just your headset.
I don't think so, but
all right, we're going to take a break. You can help support this show by becoming a member at majority.fm today, or you can, if you buy crap, if you buy crap through Amazon, go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, buy all your crap through there. We will get a kickback. That's why we call it majorityreportkickback.com. Don't forget, Credo is our sponsor this month. They're giving you a great deal, 50% off a new phone. And it's not just iPhones. It's not just Androids, folks. They've got all sorts of phones. They'll give you up to $350 credit on your to buy you out of your existing contract. And JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. We're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. If you want to be part of the program, you can IM us as well. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.